from?
Hi, my name's Colin. I'm from the, from the University of Waterloo in the Department of Applied Math, and I'm a fellow at the Institute for Nanotech. And my title could be considered a bit of a misnomer, but we'll get to that as we go along. So some things we haven't talked a lot about yet for a cancer workshop would be tumor microenvironment in general. So I'm going to go through a bit of background about that, and then I'm going to get to my model, outline my results, and then time-dependent, talk about some other projects I've been working on. So, as Robin said, it's kind of a tie-in to tomorrow, and that I'm going to pretend that I'm talking about tumor angiogenesis, which I sort of am. So I have this nice picture here which depicts the easiest interpretation you could imagine for tumor angiogenesis. You have a small clump of cells that start to get angry about not having enough oxygen. They start producing hypoxia-inducible factors, which leads to the production of angiogenic factors. And I'm going to distinguish between pro-angiogenic and anti-angiogenic factors, but the one you hear the most about is this pro-angiogenic factor, VEGF. And what it causes the nearby blood vessels to do various things. And most importantly, they start migrating and forming these vessels that then provide a nutrient and oxygen supply to the tumor, or at least to the rim after a while. Now I'm going to look at just a couple straightforward observations that we see in experiments. These are old experiments, but two facts that you want to keep in mind are that the perfusion, so the amount of blood flow you see in the tumor, is highest at the rim. So this is the rim as the tumor is growing from, say, a millimeter to bigger. And it's lowest at the core, where angiogenesis is somehow suppressed. And as we move into host tissue, we get some sort of normal amount of perfusion going on. So observation one is perfusion's highest at the core, highest at the rim, lowest at the core. Second observation would be that these pro-angiogenic growth factors, if we look at a slice through a really small tumor as well, so this is GFP here. That's some sort of fluorescent protein, which in this experiment we'll say is expressed when the VEGF promoter is working. So you see the highest VEGF promoter activity in the core, and then as you move away from the core of the tumor, you get lowest promoter activity. And we'll just think right now that this is sort of indicative of some sort of VEGF concentration, which makes sense because the cells in the middle of the tumor are hypoxic and looking for pro-angiogenic factors that will lead to vessel formation. So if you're trying to develop a mathematical model, say the easiest one you could ever imagine, you'd really want to assume that, say, vascular density is exactly proportional to growth factors. But that's not the case. So what is the next easiest model we can come up with? And after I get through about 10 more slides of background, I'll show you that the introduction of one more field, specifically an anti-angiogenic factor concentration, could lead you to a useful model. Okay? So aside from those two basic observations, it'll help us put things in context later. We also noticed that this process of angiogenesis is very poorly regulated. So the tumor loads up with pro-angiogenic growth factors, leads to very hasty and quick development of vessels, and this is bad. The vessels are very leaky, they're inefficiently structured, it leads to poor drug delivery, which is really one of the keys. And something that I will also develop a model for is that this leakiness leads to elevated interstitial fluid pressure. So lots of fluid is escaping from these tumor vessels, and that leads to solute convection out of the tumor, And I use the term short-term delivery here. What I really mean is that all these drugs, say, get delivered to the rim, which is great, but then unfortunately they get convected into the host tissue, or at least in this simplified view for small tumors.
Hold on, is
yes.
The formation of blood vessels, is that something just purely at the level of individual cells, or does it suggest some sort of cooperation between the tumor cells?
Well, I mean, it's, you could think of them as two cooperative sets of cells, but I mean, one is producing a stimulus and the other is responding. Does that answer?
Well, usually people tell us that tumor cells are deregulated.
Okay.
And they wouldn't pay much attention to what other cells are doing. So for them to,
who says that?
Hanrahan and whatever, and whatever. So if we show that there is no cooperation between tumor cells, is this blood vessel formation in the tumor, is that simply all of them are releasing it because all of them are hypoxic?
Okay, so...
This is a sort of a random response, that these tumor cells have, that these tumor cells cooperate in setting up a network?
I wouldn't say that all tumor cells are producing these factors. Also, something that was part of this last experiment I showed you was actually the original point of this experiment was actually to show that hypoxia and acidity both independently upregulate pharyngiogenic factor production. So, I mean, not additively though. So, different factors cause this production, but I would say that the hypoxic core or will always maintain the signaling, but only the cells in the, not at some time stages, only the cells at the rim will benefit from this. Okay? So, given that these vessels are so terrible.
That's why the core of many tumors is necrotic, because they don't, the blood vessels are only on the exterior and the interior doesn't benefit.
At later times, yes. At early times, you can get a purely vascularized tumor. I mean, I'm talking about millimeter scale here. Later on, the necrotic core develops due to, you know, the tumor's dividing, the vessels are collapsing in the middle, and I'm going to talk about here possibly anti-angiogenic factor suppression. Okay. So a couple of clinical goals we could make from this terrible structure is we could think of normalizing this vessel network. So have this idea of a balance of factors going on, so we could knock off some of these, or we could add some of these, and maybe restore this balance, is the idea I want you to think of. And the other one that kind of is part of thinking about anti-angiogenic treatments is normalizing the pressure, so reducing the amount of convective flux you get inside the tumor by, say, decreasing permeability and whatnot. So this is the idea, and this is a nice picture from a Jane paper, where we're somehow sort of restoring this balance by, it looks like, due to this picture, they're doing both of the aforementioned things, but say adding some anti-angiogenic growth factors to this model, and then you somehow normalize the vasculature. And this will lead to, say, improved chemotherapy delivery to the whole tumor. This is kind of, this is a theory that is makes sense intuitively, and we experimentally, there's been some things, but it's very difficult to maintain a normalized state of vasculature in a tumor. It's a very temporally short window where you either lead to excessive pruning or a reversion to abnormal structure. Why is that true?
No, why do you mind having less vessels, less blood vessels?
Okay, so let's say, and this was the original idea when anti-angiogenic agents were being developed. Well, that's great. We can knock out all the vessels, we'll starve the tumor, and it will die, right? Which makes sense. But as soon as you knock out the vessels, those cancer cells are surprisingly resilient, right? They can live in really hypoxic and acidic conditions, and they'll just start the proangiogenic signaling again, and you'll get a reversion to this abnormal structure.
So what's wrong to put a patient on a steady regimen of taking these anti-factors? The tumor can never grow.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's the question.
I mean, all.
So yeah. What's wrong with
I mean, I'll agree with that. I mean, obviously, the side effects of administering systemically some sort of anti-angiogenic agent are, you know, horrendous to the rest of your body, right? I mean, that would be my easy answer. Assuming you could deliver this specifically and I could inject it directly in the middle of the tumor, maybe we could do something.
The clinical definition of curing is that you die from something else than the tumor.
So I'll take that.
You die from something else than
the tumor. There you go. So I think one of the points that I'll make, possibly convince you kind of that maybe having some sort of anti-angiogenic agent circulating in at some low level maybe isn't a bad thing, but.
So can you actually measure this? I mean, people can reconstruct networks of blood flow. I know we have someone who reconstructs them in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, I mean, is there data from mice showing this effect, or is this just, you know, Jane's cartoon version of something that he thinks might be happening?
This is Jane's cartoon version. So, I mean, this idea has been around for, say, more than 5 years.
That's right. And
less
I always see
10.
The cartoon version. That's why I'm asking, is there some real data, even in an animal?
I could show, and I don't have any, but I could show a decent experimental picture of something that they claim is a normalized vasculature. As far as improved treatment response, it seems to be, they've convinced that you can get improved delivery a little bit,
that the vasculature is somehow normalized or improved in terms of its, so that exists, you're saying?
Something exists, and whether you'd be convinced by it or not, I would say that I'm not fully convinced by it. So, and normalization is a double-edged sword. Right. Say this was possible, and we normalize the vasculature network. The tumor also theoretically gets improved delivery of oxygen and nutrients. So, apparently, the benefits gained from that are negated by the improved delivery. But that's up for debate. And this diagram I included here just is also from Jane's paper, where they show. For high dose toxicity to normal tissues, no good, and excessive pruning is over time. And these boundaries don't make a ton of sense. So the point is,
What about the fact that some tumors just generate their own blood vessels? It's not just
vasculogenesis, So every fact that I put on my first slide about angiogenesis has multiple caveats to it. Number one is I said, you know, tumors become hypoxic, they produce factors and whatnot. They also recruit endothelial precursor cells and vasculogenesis starts up. And I don't think that's a universal characteristic, but certainly it occurs as well. Okay. So vessel normalization, sure. Well, we'll take it one step further and we'll talk about pressure normalization as well. So let's say this won't make a lot of sense until I show you the pressure profiles and whatnot. But let's say we could lower the pressure in the tumor, then theoretically we would get less convection out of the tumor. So here we have some sort of gradient, the drugs are convecting out. Here we've normalized the pressure a bit and we're getting better delivery. And these two concepts go hand in hand, but we'll get to the pressure model in a minute.
We've had a lot of mention of pressure. Is this
so far in this talk?
Or osmotic pressure, or is it the homeostatic pressure of our French friends?
I'm talking about interstitial fluid pressure, so maybe that'll be
hypostatic pressure of the fluid, interstitial.
Sure. I mean, I'm going to make a steady state assumption and whatnot, but okay.
That's different from the pressure in the vasculature.
Yeah, the vascular pressure will be just a parameter in this homogenized model. And osmotic pressure will end up doesn't really play a role in tumor vessels, at least.
So are you going to give us some numbers for how high pressure actually measured to go?
I'm going to
Just imagine that Michael Rubenstein is still in the audience.
I imagine him right there. He would have had some questions, and I could predict what they were on some slides to come. So, you know, my build up here maybe wasn't it wasn't interspersed with some modeling facts, but I'm going to get to the pressure and whatnot. And so models exist for pressure, and we have some measurements, and I'll show you some numbers. And models have existed for angiogenic growth factors. And I'm going to try and convince you that the convective flux is very important when you consider angiogenesis. And I mean, this first bullet here is really just an interesting fact and maybe will pique biophysics people's interest. It's not really a part of the model, but it's sort of, there's a strong relationship of some kind between interstitial flow and angiogenesis.
What do you mean that VGF does not produce capillaries?
This is just, I'll explain the experiment. It's a little dish. When was this done? So this is in 2005. They just threw some endothelial cells in there, and they just put the put VEGF in. And what they saw was just they divide and they don't form any structure. And
I can show you opposite experiments that they actually do.
Okay.
Actually, Arispe has done some of these things, I think.
Okay. And then I guess, and then their point was that at least in these cells, that you had to add interstitial flow in order to get some structure to form. And by structure, I don't mean just a blob of
cells. It doesn't necessarily contradict what you say. He's just saying that you need a delivery system for the VGF. Interstitial flow, right?
Well, this is...
What kind of VGF was that? There's different isoforms of VGF.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you. And I mean, this statement right here doesn't really affect anything that's going to come, I don't think. Are you familiar with this paper? It was kind of a mishmash between experimental work and the mathematical model. So, but I think that was their. This was their finding. And I would imagine that there could be works that contradict that fact. Okay. And the other part is these factors are, you know, a couple order of magnitudes bigger than, say, a glucose molecule. And so their transport in some sort of porous media is likely governed by diffusion in convection. So summary, last slide before the quick model is just to summarize. Tumor microenvironment. So we have high interstitial fluid pressure, we have hypoxia, and something that I might not even get to is this low pH, which is due to some altered metabolism. And all these factors are very tightly interconnected, and the relationships between them are interesting to me. Okay, so this is going to lead to an angiogenic growth factor model, and this model derivation isn't that exciting. I'm considering the concentration of some macromolecule being produced at some rate P, and I assume that the flux is a sum of a diffusive and convective element. So I induce Fick's law, and I assume some solute velocity. And the assumption I'm going to make here is we have some sort of retardation coefficient that relates the solute velocity to the fluid velocity U. And for these angiogenic growth factors, I'm going to make the simplest assumption I can make about the production rate, or I should say, you know, the production rate minus the degradation rate, and that they're constant. Different constants inside and outside the tumor.
V is
the velocity of the solute, say, and U is the fluid velocity. And I'm just saying they're proportional because I'm going to develop a model for fluid velocity. Not develop a model, I'm going to seal a model. And so here's my actual angiogenic growth factor equation. So I'm splitting them up into two different categories, pro-angiogenic and anti-angiogenic. The validity of that could be debated. But I'm assuming that it's in some sort of sphere of radius R, and it's going to be embedded in some other tissue. So I'm going to have some boundary conditions that include continuity and whatnot. And these parameters are going to change drastically at the tumor boundary, which is a decent first approximation. So the diffusion coefficients, the production, and the degradation will differ slightly inside and outside. And having said that, some of these can be measured, some of them can't. The fact that I'm actually talking vaguely about some anti-angiogenic ability endowed and some anti-angiogenic and pro-angiogenic ability endowed, the main thing is going to be the relationship between the tumor and host parameters and between the two factor group parameters.
So the diffusion,
Yes.
Are you imagining it as a simple passive diffusion, like a particle in the fluid, which is presumably very low, I would guess?
The concentration is very low?
No, the diffusion coefficient.
So let's say...
Does it have some sort of active component as well, because it has to get past these cells, right?
Yeah. I'm gonna say no, but that could play a role. Yeah.
Okay. These are measured from the distance that you're talking about, right? Centimeters or something.
Less than that. Say less than a centimeter. More like millis.
Well, but you're doing it on fairly long time scales, right? Days or something.
Yeah, I'm just gonna look at the solutions to these in steady state, right? So. Yeah, something where the tumor...
Would there be hydrodynamic contribution to diffusion anyway, because you have flow in some complicated environment? So, of course, you're approximating it by the mean flow to get some mean convection, but there's local seepage, mixing, eddy, whatever.
Yeah. The water beside going through the vesicles also slowly permeating this whole thing.
Yeah.
They carry this.
Yeah.
And
the
general effects
are
limited.
Right. That's what I'm saying. There's probably some contribution to past molecular diffusion, for instance.
I would guess so, because it is so slow.
And what's the velocity profile you're
showing
for you?
Show you.
And constant?
Two slides. Okay. And so when for most. Boring slide of the workshop. The boundary conditions for that model.
I also love it, boundary conditions.
So, hopefully you can follow it. Spherical symmetry at the core, continuity of fluxes and concentrations at the tumor boundary, and then as we go off into infinity, obviously numerically I can't go to infinity, but it's approaching the steady state. Okay, and this is my tricking you into thinking that this equation is easy to derive. I'll start with, say, steady state incompressible flow, the continuity equation for that, and then I'll assume that the fluid moving across the vessel wall is given by Starling's law, which tells you that it's basically the difference between the vascular pressure, which we'll assume is some constant, and the interstitial pressure. In a tumor, the osmotic pressure difference really doesn't come into it because this reflection coefficient is 5 orders of magnitude less than a normal vessel.
I know about Darcy's law. Starling's law is very similar, except it's for a finite distance.
Right. So I mean, So this is just talking about transport across the vessel wall. This is technically talking about the conductivity through the interstitium.
That's exactly what Herbie and me were suggesting. That's what might carry your stuff along.
Okay. Okay. And in steady state, this derivation looks pretty simple. So we'll stick to that. And you can derive this formula for pressure in steady state, where, as you can probably see already, after non-dimensionalization, we're going to get something, only one parameter here, and we can non-dimensionalize the pressure by effective pressure.
Capital phi is the surface area of the vessel wall.
Per unit volume of the tumor. So kind of the interface.
Do you know that? That's known from clinical studies. It's a complicated thing.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end of the day, in the models I'm working on now, not in this that I'm going to show you, certainly the surface area per unit volume varies drastically as you move radially through the tumor.
From what happens, let's say, in an embryo, in the very early stage of an embryo growth, would you dare presume you also have the first specimen, or that's similar to this? Would you apply the same model to an embryo?
Are you talking about vasculogenesis?
It must be, when an embryo grows, it also has to produce.
This model is not even going to get around to predicting what angiogenesis looks like. I'm just going to propose a mechanism for what goes on. But no, I wouldn't. Unless.
Can you rephrase it? During embryogenesis, is there similar release of this vector, this vegetable vector?
VEGF?
Is there a similar release? At some point, a growing embryo also has. What is the precise difference between a developing cancer and a developing embryo in terms of continuum?
You just blew my mind a little bit, but right. I mean, the vasculogenesis in an embryo. I know 99% of what I'm about to say I've learned in the past 3 weeks. So. The stem cells produce some sort of endothelial precursor, and then that endothelial precursor turns into a vascular network. I don't know what VEGF role in that is, but...
I don't either. I was just asking, could this work in the same way?
I was
thinking about these lectures from Barney, where he suggests that you see the signaling of these embryonic stem cells. So maybe this is similar to how in an early embryo did.
Yeah, I'm not sure that an embryo has a hypoxic response or not.
I don't know either.
My intuition would be I hope not, because that would mean as your embryos are, you have a hypoxic area, which seems scary. But. Okay, that's pressure model. I need to non-dimensionalize all these equations, and the reason for that is that I need to develop a measure of angiogenic activity, which is math speak that I'll explain in a second. But for now, I'm going to non-dimensionalize this equation. This is from the work of Jane, predominantly. This is the parameter of power. Power in the sense of not physics related. And that's the ratio of some sort of transport from the vessel that's contained in this permeability, LP, over the conductivity through the interstitium. And I have similar boundary conditions for the pressure and velocity profiles.
Are the radius capillaries radius of the tumor?
Sure is, yeah. Capillaries radius of the tumor, and I'm in a non-dimensionalized space with that.
And case conductivity is the interstitial.
Right. Say anything that's outside a cell. I think I lied to you when I said the pressure profile was coming in two slides. It's coming in two slides now, though.
But by the way, the paper you mentioned doesn't say what you say.
Really?
Just look at it. The title of the paper is Synergy Between Interstitial Flow and VGF Directs.
Damn internet. Go on.
Direct capillary morphogenesis in vitro.
Okay.
So all it says is that the flow rearranges the VDF, the VGF, and that organizes the capillary. Just to...
Okay. My paraphrase was too far. That's fair. And the sad part was that I was just trying to arouse your curiosity. So, what do I have there? Here's a non-dimensionalized system. So I non-dimensionalized the pressure and the factor concentrations with their steady states. And I non-dimensionalized the velocity as well, but that doesn't overly matter. So I took a system with, say, 20-something parameters, and now we have, it looks like 8, but that's still a lie, right? Because these differ between proangiogenic and anti-angiogenic factors. They're all in the same order, but that's okay as well. So I have some non-dimensional parameters for production and degradation. I'm only going to look at those very briefly because that's been done possibly to death. But I'm going to look at what these molecular transport and fluid transport parameters do for the model. And possibly one consequence of the model in general, but these non-dimensional parameters don't divvy up nicely into two groups. Mr. Conductivity is present in both. So I'll look at, say, increasing this one, decreasing this one simultaneously.
Can you go back one slide for a second?
Yep.
So you don't have in this model yet the fact that these angiogenic factors will eventually change, like, the surface area of your vessels and things?
No, no. But I mean, that is exactly what a dynamical model needs to do. For sure. I mean,
depending on boundary conditions, moving boundary conditions.
Yeah, then we're in a little bit of trouble, but certainly tumor radius is constant in this model. For dynamic models, say you want a tumor growth model, you're definitely going to want to make this time dependent. Yeah.
It could be very sexy. You might have surface instabilities and all of that.
It could be very sexy. I have a lot of preliminary results for that sort of thing. We have more, you know. Spherical symmetry is not overly exciting, but if you're interested, I can show you some pretty pictures at some point. For now, we're sticking to non-pretty pictures. Okay, so what do I want to do with all this stuff? I have velocity, and I have anti and pro-angiogenic factors, and I said all I want is some way to predict angiogenic activity, not just from pro-angiogenic factors, but ask me something more complicated. So I introduce anti-angiogenic factors. This is the part where, this is why mathematical, not physics, is in my title. This is a leap. Okay, so mathematically, we like to divvy things up into different categories and classes, and we introduce this thing called angiogenic activity. And try not to get wrapped up into this functional form. It doesn't really matter what this functional form is. All that really matters, and I mean, we don't really know what that is, or even if this mechanism is what's actually going on, but the key parts of what this function must exhibit is that when the normalized pro-angiogenic and anti-angiogenic factors are equal, say in the host tissue, you have nothing going on. So say the angiogenic activity equals zero. When there's more pro than anti, you have something going on, and this measure has to be bigger than zero. And then when you have more anti than pro, then A is less than zero, and say vessels are regressing due to anti-angiogenic treatment, or something like that. Okay, so this choice of measuring angiogenic activity was something done, just one choice, it was done by a group, not the original paper where this was kind of looked at. Another way you could think of it is just look at the ratio of the two, and then if it's equal to one, it's stable. If it's bigger than one, it's initiated, and less than one, it's regressing. Okay? And then mathematically, what we want to do with this model, I keep saying that word, is talk about these angiogenic activity classes, which are kind of just a way of quantifying this into being able to do some sensitivity analyses on this model. So we see three different types of behavior. Global angiogenesis, where, say, it's always bigger than zero. You only ever see this in a very small tumor, or in some unusual cases. Typically, we get focal suppression, where it's suppressed at the core, and it's vascularized at the rim. And then something you practically never see is global suppression, where the effect of anti-angiogenic activities is overwhelming pro-angiogenic factors everywhere. You would have to induce that in a primary tumor. The only other thing you could look at really is you see global suppression in metastatic sites. So just due to the fact that the decay rates of pro-angiogenic factors is much quicker than anti-angiogenic factors. So you'll see, you may have heard of this phenomenon where someone gets a primary tumor removed, and then that encourages the growth at metastatic sites. That was a side note that I got distracted, but the purpose is to analyze what goes on when I change these non-dimensional parameters. Believe it or not, I can solve these equations, and you know, I'll prove it to you by writing down the velocity profile and showing it to you. And you can solve analytically for growth factors, but you can't with convection, clearly. And then from there, I determine a measure of angiogenic activity. This is a classical thing that you see in pressure modeling for solid tumors embedded in some host tissue. You get, as this alpha parameter goes up, so just to remind you, this is what alpha is. So as, say, the permeability increases or the amount of vessels increases, then the pressure goes up inside the tumor. And it decreases when you hit the boundary, which is at R equal to 1, and decreases to some to 0 in the host tissue, which isn't, we'll ignore that for now. And the interesting thing is that as alpha increases, the velocity inside the tumor decreases, but at the rim, it grows larger. So this flat pressure leads to low velocities inside, and this steep gradient leads to high velocities at the rim. Okay. Now I'm going to show you what the factor concentrations look like. So this is a very unfair comparison, but assuming you take the base case of parameters and ignore convection, you get these red curves. And you get this little spike of angiogenic behavior at the rim, and then back to some normalized value. If you add convection to the model, and this is, you know, what we're trying to say, is that a lot of these factors that were inside in the no convection case get pushed out into the host tissue. And if you measure angiogenesis in some sort of way as the difference between these two, like I did with that functional form before, these factor concentrations get driven apart. And what that leads to is this higher spike here. And you still get some, but not as much, suppression at the core. So not a fair comparison yet, but I'll compare this blue curve now with some other curves that would be fair to compare it with. Before I get to that, though, I'll show you, just so you don't think I'm totally off the deep end, I'll show one correlation.
Yeah, plotting. Sorry. A on the
y-axis? Okay, so this is factor concentrations, and this is this measure, A. So this is some sort of, this is just showing, because it's hard to tell from this picture, and because we like to talk about this sort of thing, this is basically just the ratio minus 1. Just so you can see the difference. So when it's bigger than 0, all that means is that FP is bigger than FA. And when it's less than 0, just means that it's less than FP. And I'm calling these positive areas stimulation and negative areas suppression. Okay?
Well, yeah. Can you figure and sketch to me the flow pattern? I'm not sure I can visualize it.
I'm not sure I know what that means.
Okay. Let's see what we can manage.
Yeah.
So how does it flow? Is it radially inward from the boundary and radially outward? Or?
Convective?
Yeah, so how's the convective flow look like? So
it's outward.
So it was on the previous transparency, wasn't it?
Yeah, you have this spike. Yeah, that's right.
Say that again.
There.
Yeah. Positive. Yeah.
Positive.
Yeah, it's positive.
So it's always flowing outward.
Yeah, I mean that's not something to radially out of there.
And what is supplying the fluid which leaves?
Blood vessels which are leaking fluid.
So that's everywhere into the tumor. So
yes, unfortunately.
I'm inserting fluid everywhere.
Yeah.
And then it is flowing outward radially.
It's a distributed source, which...
Hence you have cusp at the size of the tumor because there is no more supply of fluid.
Well, there's some, but not as much.
Okay, I got it.
But yeah, the constant surface area per volume would be the first assumption to go, right?
What kind of value would this be in a realistic
This, like the peak of this, for instance?
Any value, yeah. What is one?
Okay. Well, I'll have to go back to non-dimensional. Well, the velocity will be about 0.1 micrometers per second. Right. So k is like 10 to the negative 5 millimeters squared per second per millimeter mercury. The effective pressure is around 10 millimeters of mercury, and the radius is, say, a millimeter. So I'd say about 0.1 to 0.1 micrometers per second.
Yeah, you can probably figure it out from simple capillaries because that's what's supplying.
Yeah. And I mean, for here, the pressure one is whatever your effective pressure is, which.
Shouldn't there be a lot of pressure in capillaries again, right?
So anyways, here's some vague association with necrotic volume of a tumor. And this is just so we can have some correlation between the suppression, and we can talk about necrosis. So if we assume that the necrotic volume is proportional to the suppressed volume in some way, and we compare to this data. So here's the percent necrotic volume as we increase volume. So this
is experimental data.
Yeah, these dots are experimental data. All of these lines are different values of this proportionality constant with the model. And the point is, if you assume that half of that suppressed region eventually dies, then you get an interesting fit there.
Can you quickly remind me what suppressed volume is?
Suppressed volume would be amount. As soon as it's less than zero, we assume it's suppressed, and then, you know, that gives us the radius, and then, you know, we cube the radius. Okay, so now I'm just going to look at what happens to varying different parameters. I'm going to relate this to how you would think about this in the context of treatment eventually. So as I change this alpha parameter, the velocity decreases in the core, and it increases at the rim, and the effect of that is more and more of these factors are being pushed out, and it's driving these concentration differences apart at the rim. And so you get higher activity at the rim, and you get lower activity at the core due to these factors being pushed out. So that's the altering the pressure parameter, which we'll say is kind of like altering permeability or surface area per volume. We can also alter the convection parameter, and as you would expect, it's just driving, nothing's really happening at the core because there's low velocities, and it's driving the factors apart at the rim and leading to higher angiogenic activity. And this is interesting in treatment context as well that I'll get to. And finally, something that, you know, we're never quite sure if this is a good idea in cancer therapy or not, is whether changing the value of K, the conductivity, is a good idea or a bad idea. And this kind of suggests that it could be a bad idea. I wouldn't hang my hat on it, but if I change K, then that has the effect, say I increase it, then it decreases alpha, increases the convection parameter, and I get both a rise of angiogenic activity at the core and at the rim, which isn't great. So I'm going to summarize how you could think of these various parameter changes in the context of therapy. So these first couple and the last one I didn't really discuss because they're production and degradation. Pseudo straightforward effects, you could say. I'll show one slide about those in a minute. But you could assume that anti-angiogenic therapies correspond to some increase in antiogenic production, a decrease in proangiogenic degradation, blah, blah, blah. But mostly what we're interested in is vessel normalization, or how that corresponds to these parameters. So you could say as vessels become more normal, the permeability is going down, so alpha is going down, which look to be pretty good from angiogenic activity perspective, or this decreased surface area, same thing could be happening with anti-angiogenic therapy, and decreased resistance, which you would really only, you can induce by some blood thinners or something, probably not a great idea, but you could decrease the convective parameter in that case. And then finally, something that was discussed but never really decided on is whether trying to alter specifically the conductivity of the tissue is a good idea. And I would say with middling levels of certainty that it probably wouldn't be a great idea. If you believe that there's some sort of mechanism where the difference in the factor concentrations drives angiogenesis. Okay, so, and this is just showing you what happens when you change production and degradation rates, which I didn't talk about in my own. So the usefulness of this kind of thought process would be something that if anyone's interested, we can talk about, because I don't have any more slides on this stuff, is incorporation into a tumor model. And that's the goal. So using a model that has vasculature, density, tumor density, factor concentrations, pressure, and therefore interstitial fluid velocity. And then, of course, it makes sense in that context to talk about therapies that could be delivered as well. But I'll save that for another time. So the conclusions from this part are that convection has some sort of complicated effect on angiogenesis, and perhaps not just changing the production and degradation rates of these terms, but also looking at the physiological parameters of tumors could impact and does impact angiogenesis behavior and probably drug delivery as well. And finally, the extension of this is to include it in a tumor model, and this suspicion that conductivity plays a debatable role still exists.
Can you remind me what IFP stands for?
IFP, interstitial fluid pressure. So if you have questions about that, I'm just going to briefly go through the two other projects I'm working on. Angiogenesis related one was just a tie-in with tomorrow's stuff. But I do other things.
Yeah? Your model have any way of, Avastin, you want to comment on that? Does that work? Would that be stressing the pro-angiogenesis?
You could alter a parameter to correspond to it. You really need a time-dependent model with some sort of dosage curve over time, right, to look at what actual treatment regimens would do. Yeah. Okay, so.
What about measurements? What's the smallest pressure probe that exists? Does anybody have a nanoparticle out there that can report pressure, either in a mouse or in a person eventually?
I would love to know. The experimental data that those pressure curves are fit to are 15 years old at least. So I don't know if the technology's come anywhere. I haven't seen anything other than that.
Who was the pressure measure, the perfusion measured in the 1979 paper? Do you know how it is?
The 1979 paper. Which
on the second slide.
What's that?
On your second slide, you had some data.
Second slide. Oh, the perfusion data?
Yes.
That was in rats. What kind of engineer?
How did they measure the perfusion?
The perfusion? I'm not exactly sure either. So that was a 79 paper, though. Right.
I mean, you can put tumors in mice with these skin flaps and sort of be able to image various things. You should be able to image the flow.
Yeah, I mean, one of the...
putting stuff in there, just watch it flow.
And a very interesting problem is, if you think of the inverse problem, try and predict the velocity profile from some macromolecule concentration profile. But I don't know about measuring pressure directly.
But I'm not sure you can do continuum assumptions in microcapillaries that are leaking in blood vessels, however. Because the blood is all composed of these blood cells. I mean, you have 2, 3, 4 layers of blood cells. You have white cells.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure this continuum, it would be nice, but it would help a lot, because the other is a nightmare to model.
Yeah, I mean.
So I don't know how this can be applicable somehow. It's difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, spherical symmetry, for instance, starts falling apart on the millimeter scale unless you interpret it as some distribution of density. And we're assuming basically there's some solid portion of this thing which is actually comprised of, you know, dozens of different types of cells. And yeah, continuum assumption is what it is.
You mentioned, so you proposing testing by releasing some marker into the bloodstream and seeing how the profile, how it radiates outward, what is the flow rate of this micromolecule or fluorescent or radio marker from mm-hmm. the center of the tumor to the outside and compare different tumors in flow profile. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now,
yeah, you should be able to do that.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Well, you could do that.
You could solve,
we
theoretically.
But I don't think this
like
is easy.
We have, why not? Why
you do it in angioplasty all the time, right?
You do
it in angioplasty. When they put a stent in your heart, that's what they do. They put a dye to see.
Well, you have to first of all, make sure that the dye arrives at the tumor and it has enough capacity. And then when you see the dye coming out, what does this tell you? What is it attached to this part?
No, you have to put a needle through a vessel and go into the tumor. It's possible to do. I'm not sure that there's data available, but I don't think in principle it's
possible. Take a needle and go to the blood vessel?
Yes, that's what they do when they put a stent in your heart. How do they do it? They go to the femoral artery, they go up there, and they can...
These are bigger things, yeah.
Not necessarily. The blockage is in small vessels, and so they go to... It's not capillary size, but you can see capillary size once you inject the dye, because the heart pumps it up.
But then you can see the diffusion of the dye in there, and you can see, how do you distinguish what is flow, what is diffusion of the dye? These are very noisy things that the geometry is not clear. You have things like the glycocalyx on the surface of the endothelial cells. I don't know if it's keen to... It would be fantastic. Someone can measure it. I think that would be fantastic.
Well, they show you a video, so clearly they can take a movie of this thing happening, right?
But there's a big difference to see a movie. There's people like Dvorak from the old days that they could do all these visualizations, but do measurements of flow. I don't know if anybody has done it near tumors. Maybe Jain has done it. I don't know.
Not recently.
Is that what's blood flow, right? It was the T1. Luckily, you put in a contrast
gadolinium,
and you look at
blood. Our Doppler flossometry, the Doppler flossometry, you can measure blood vessel speed. So I assume that
these are small.
These are small.
Yeah. So
that's
the question
is,
what you can do.
Well, you need to track some type of dye or something.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to be such a impossible.
It would be nice if you can color the blood cells that are leaking out somehow. That could be a fair.
Your transport is not blood vessels, it's fluid flow, right? I'm not sure that there's any transport of blood cells to your tumor, right?
And right, no, so certainly not in a homogeneous model, no.
So you really have to do small dyes to see it. And I think it's neither diffusion or flow, but permeation. I think it's delivered by all of these leaky vessels, and it permeates outward like a sponge or a porous medium. I think that's the picture.
There's the EPR effect, right? There's this Ida, what is the Japanese guy that has discovered this? I forget the name now. And I think they have some measurements of flow rates and such things, but these are not detailed. They're very coarse-grained.
I think people can also grow tumors in vitro, right?
Yeah.
And they will do angiogenesis if you in vitro.
They could.
So if you can do that, then you can really do a careful experiment.
Yeah, I need an army of experimentalist slaves, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So
I guess the point is that at some point this whole approach has to be validated in some way, otherwise it's, you know.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, there should be some type of average profile you can get by measurement that agrees with this, otherwise it's not going to go very far.
Yeah, as far as pressure profile goes?
As far as flow, whatever, concentration profile, flow profile, whatever.
Yeah, certainly.
Whatever is the right, the thing you can do experimentally to test this this picture. So.
Yeah.
And maybe it has a signature when metastasis happens. Does it mean that the thing becomes suddenly more leaky, perhaps?
The primary tumor?
Yes. Does the primary tumor become softer and more leaky and when it becomes metastatic?
I don't know that vessel leakiness plays a role in that.
Primary tumor doesn't change much.
Okay. Yeah, but do we know this for sure? I mean, it could be that the adhesion between the cells on average decreases somewhat.
The cells are also trying to escape their terrible microenvironment. Extravasate through lymphatics and blood vessels.
There's no more questions.
Part two and three are, you know, four slides each because I knew I wasn't going to have time and I wanted to talk briefly about that, but these ones, you know, if you are curious about either of the two things to come, you know, maybe we can talk about it later. But the other two things I'm interested specifically with are tumor metabolism and optimizing treatment combinations. And perhaps these will be more invested in a world you'll like. So in normal tissue, epoxy leads to increased glycolysis. And of course, as we've heard a lot about in tumor tissue, we have this hypoxic effect, but also in addition to that, due to various reasons and with multiple explanations, we see aerobic glycolysis. So in the presence of oxygen, tumor cells still are pumping in tons of glucose and performing lots of glycolysis. And that's a nice picture of the cell. And a very interesting experiment was done by Helmlinger and their group. Also about 15 years ago now, and this interesting phenomenon occurred. So there's a single vessel here, and this is radial distance outside of that vessel. And these measurements are done in something like in 14 tumors in 7 different vessels. And you notice this very interesting global effect. You see increase in oxygen, which is expected. And then perhaps something that they weren't expecting to see, which was a bump in this pH profile. So at hypoxic areas, say 100 to 200 micrometers away from a single vessel, you see this plateau. And you think, oh, I could mathematically model that. And then the pH begins to decrease again. So there's something going on here, probably. People like to point out that, you know, you could get something without a plateau getting through all those error bars, but that's okay. It looks like something's happening here.
How big is the tumor?
I'm not sure. The vessel, it's a microvessel, so it's on the order of 10 micrometers. Okay, so this is small.
The microvessel of the tumor.
Yes, these are
the vitro or in vivo.
I want to say in vivo. I wouldn't bet on it. Okay.
There is no other microvessel up to 400 microns.
There's no.
It's air isolated. You have one microvessel.
Oh, okay. So they only measure up to a point 400 away. They say that's a distance where you won't have any interference from, say, another nearby vessel.
How does a normal vessel look like? There's also a pH difference in a normal vessel.
Well, for one, you won't get the oxygen decreasing to these levels, right? In fact, here's normal tissue oxygen levels compared to these tumor volumes. pH will decrease a little bit to the steady state value in your body, say. But yeah, it is a little bit higher near your vessel still.
Because that's where you, depending on where you're in the brain or elsewhere, you have higher or lower pH because of the releasing or absorbing oxygen.
Right. But and so this drops all the way to 6.7, say, which is quite acidic as far as trying to live with acidities. And some colleague in my group, Hamid Malabian, had a hypothesis in that you could get this system by saying, or get this prediction by saying that it's respiration dominated here, some combination here, and then only when you get into the bulk of the tumor do you have a glycolysis dominated cells.
So could we get into Warburg effect so that we have
a little bit.
That we have glycolysis.
So you, the Warburg effect's included in some of these production rates. So you can change some of these parameters to alter the ratio of oxygen consumption to glucose consumption. And in one slide version of this model, the original model would be just include these two basic reactions, which is respiration, oxygen and glucose form these non-harmful byproducts. And glycolysis forms lactate and, say, two hydrogen ions, assuming that
isn't all the make this is okay. Arnie mentioned it.
Okay, so that's, I mean, the net reaction here is this. Pyruvate would be somewhere in this respiration pathway. Okay, and include the most important buffer in the body, which is bicarbonate buffer. So it can neutralize, say, a single hydrogen ion. And sodium and chloride are implicitly in the model. And we're interested in looking at the pH that results from this. These extracellular concentrations are modeled using those production rates, which were derived in another paper by Cassiari in 92. And this is a setup of the geometry. So it's some tissue outside of a vessel.
Vessel on the left?
Yeah. Just like in the pictures. And you get a pretty good fit here, I suppose. And the oxygen profile is here, and the pH prediction is there. And the two things you have to input into the model are a consumption rate of glucose and a consumption rate of oxygen. So this is some sort of functional form that Hamid derived or figured out to get the results of this model. And so I don't have any slides about my work, but I can tell you two easy things I did were, same trick as last time, add convection. In a single vessel, convection, the velocities are so small, the convective flux really only plays a role in the first tens of micrometers, and so that really didn't do much. I changed from Cartesian to cylindrical coordinates, that didn't do much, and canceled out any effect of convection. And so now, something I'm working on is seeing what other types of consumption rates would lead to this pH plateau. And my hypothesis in my mind right now is that this glucose consumption rate, I must be able to get this plateau with, instead of it decreasing here, perhaps increasing here. And so I have some preliminary results for this that I'm not going to show. But my thought on this model is that there must be some sets or some parameter space of consumption rates that would lead to, varying lengths of plateaus, locations of plateaus, and to look at that, those relationships for this microvessel model.
Okay. 1D in the radial direction.
Yeah. The vessel's here. In this picture, it's a wall, but in my simulation, it's a cylinder.
Is there any chance
the
lymphatic system has anything to do with
that? What's the first assumption every in my last model made too? No lymphatics. And I mean, that's true for some tumors and not true at all for others, and kind of true for a lot, right? So lymphatic drainage, that sink term is always set to zero. So you could look at the role of that.
It's 10 microns,
it's
the
radius. Approximately. It would be nice if I knew, say, the distribution of radii of these vessels that they measured these concentrations from. Okay? So that's brief outline number two. And number three is something that I just finished a couple weeks ago while I was here. This was some cell viability prediction from protein concentration measurement. So this is an oversimplified picture, so take it for what it is. We administer nanoparticles, which have various great qualities, improved delivery, sustained release, blah, 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 and we put cisplatin, and that's a chemotherapy agent that kills cells, basically. And what you see experimentally are two things. Well, and by see experimentally two things, I mean the two things that were measured by this experimentalist where I got this data was PAC and caspase expression. You can think of PAC as some sort of good thing and caspase as some sort of bad thing for the cell, or clinically the opposite. We think PAC is bad and caspase is good. So unfortunately, when you apply cisplatin nanoparticles, both go up. And this is part of the mechanism behind chemo resistance. So we see over time the upregulation of both. And what's the obvious way to overcome these pro-survival signals? Well, let's knock them out with some molecular inhibitor. It's called PI-828, and this blocks PI-3K, which phosphorylates ACT. And let's see if that solves our problem. And our goal would be, what's the temporal optimized sequence of these two drugs? And I'll sneak in this nanoparticle release profile that's an interesting area, I suppose, of medical physics. Yeah, I would be interested in that as well. There's 10,000 models in the literature. Experimentalists love to use two-parameter models that don't really have much of this physical justification. And, you know, physicists like to use 77-parameter models that involve all the processes, and I like to stay somewhere in between. But
my co-organizer for Utaminoi are just eight.
Yeah, dissolution, diffusion, erosion, all things that I'm sure are interesting. So we propose a simple, we call this qualitative model for how these two things are interact with each other. We just assume they're mutually inhibitory, and then the other parameters are production and decay, and then we have some upregulation by cisplatin and some inhibition by PI-828 in the protein equations, and we get this lovely fit. And I'm hiding all sorts of parameters on you for this release profile and the drug delivery. And so this is with exposure to the cisplatin nanoparticle. And then this is showing the inhibition of PAC when you add PI-828. And this is showing the synergistic effect of giving cisplatin for 24 hours, measurements don't exist, and then giving PI-828 after. And as you see, compared to when I gave some sort of placebo, instead of PI-828, I get a lot more caspase. And as you can see, this effect is higher, but...
Can you give an intuitive explanation why the CASP you don't want, right?
CASP I love for treatment because it's killing the cell.
Okay, the other one you're
yeah, I don't want PAC because it's keeping the cell alive.
So how does the PAC go up? Is it in response?
Mechanistically, I mean, I don't know, and I don't know.
So you put in by hand a term in the equation, a coupling term in the. Okay, so it's
absolutely
a reasonable model, but how do I ever prove you wrong?
Yeah.
Can
you understand what I mean? Well, that's the best hypothesis to make, right? You can't.
Seriously, so you have a reasonable assumption, but how can we test a model like this?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to make me extrapolate, I suppose. And I mean, a lot of those linear assumptions are going to fall apart. So, I mean, the effects, to isolate each effect, chances are they're all nonlinear. Chances are they depend, well, not chances are, they definitely depend on other protein concentrations. But we're playing a fun game. Say I only have caspase and PAC concentration, and I want to predict what cell viability is going to be. Can I do it or can't I?
It's like an engineer, and you use it actually as a sort of fitting of known data and check to see if you can use it.
So far, the only parameters that I know in this model are decay rate. And certainly production isn't constant, but it fits the data pretty well, assuming that. So we'll take it. Okay? So if you didn't like that, you're really going to love this. So now we predict cell viability from these two concentrations, making the simplest assumption possible, which is that it's staying alive due to this concentration and dying due to this concentration. And it turns out that I can find two parameters by fitting this data that models this okay. Chances are, if I wanted to make something that fit this data better, I would have to introduce some non-linear birth and death effects. And then we want to know whether I can say anything about, just from this model alone, whether or not PI-828 administered after 24 hours is a good idea, whether I should shift it sooner or push it later. And I made a prediction just based on this parameter fitting and assumptions that we should probably move it a little bit closer. So here's what they did. And green, and then the best cell viability outcome is in blue, which is after 24 hours. So still waiting on that confirmation. But apparently this, you know, this drug that they've been using to inhibit this production is so popular that it was sold out of the lab, and it's on back order. Oh, that's an acronym for cisplatin nanoparticle. Self-assembled is all that means. They're proud of that. Okay, so that's a final thing that I was working on recently. And I just want to thank my supervisor, Mohammed, who may be here later on, and Hamid, who was involved with the microvessel modeling originally, and Amberish and Dr. Sengupta, who help me get the tumor response data for the treatment effects. And thanks to my funders as well.
Thanks.